Oi, you. It's time for another episode of Dorothy and the Dealer. Let's tune into the conversation.
Okay, this episode is all about making Amelia Gale cry, so...
It's not gonna happen.
That's what's, yeah, that's just exactly what she loves.
I know.
Do you know that Amelia was our very, 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 very first guest on the Dorothy and the Dealer podcast?
No shit.
She was.
Wow.
Yeah, you were. Ah. I'm pretty sure you were. It's a good story. You were close to the first if you weren't the first. And telling your story about... all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do remember it. It was lovely.
Welcome. Mm. Do you have a song that you, because I know we've got a specific story and chat that we're going to have today, but do you have a song that's your go-to at the moment that you can sing for us?
Mm. I don't sing.
Speak into the microphone.
My song for life is Under Pressure, David Bowie and Freddie Mercury.
And Freddie Mercury. That version is pretty good.
Stop, collaborate and listen.
That's a completely different song, you ninny.
I know.
How are you, AG?
I am wonderful.
Okay, there's a lot of time passed since we last had our conversation. And back in the day, you weren't working with us. You were speaking on the podcast as a client guest. And a lot has happened since then because you moved over from Queensland to join us at MJB, which is awesome.
Never looked back.
Never looked back.
Liar.
It's been a couple of years now, hasn't it?
Well, now you're living with chickens.
You have a whole chicken life up in the hills.
Quindas, what is it, galahs? You got a galah up there?
That's Reggie.
And quick fun fact, Amelia names all her chickens after her family and friends. Yeah, so there was a Mitch and Mills.
But he got
but
killed
they,
by
they
fox.
Got killed.
Yeah, by
then
Mr.
my
fox.
Dog ate your heads.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
The puppy?
Yeah.
A little shit.
Fair enough, though.
He's a very cute puppy, though, isn't he?
He's a good boy.
He is. I love Wolfie. Wolf! Okay, let's go. Come on.
Okay.
What are we talking about?
We're getting there.
I just want to make her cry.
Okay. Let's go. Well, you've been on a massive journey, and I think you wanted to share a little bit of the journey that you've been on. And I think we might just handball to you a second so that you can start things off, start the ball rolling and talking about that journey. And we'll ask you some questions as we go.
Sure. So this is a journey that has spanned 22 years. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I briefly have spoken about, but I've never been in a position to actually talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So 22 years ago when I was 16, I was, as you all know, delinquent. I was off the rails. I was out of home. I'd moved to England. I'd come back. But at this particular time, I was really unwell. Like, not delinquency, drugs unwell. I was physically really sick. And my mom stepped up, as she always does, to fix my problems. And we went to all the healers, the doctors, the Ayurvedic specialists. I had liver disorders, I had kidney disorders, I had hormone problems, I had all these things. And I, you know, was prescribed everything under the sun. And then one day after, I had these really bad stomach pains, and I went to my just local GP, and he told me to get up on the bench, lie down, lift up my shirt. He felt my stomach, and his eyes went wide. He stepped back, and he said, "You're not sick, you're pregnant. And you're not just pregnant, that baby just kicked me."
Really?
At how many months, 6 or 7?
So we didn't know then, but at the time, I was 6 months pregnant.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I remember.
So you thought you had kidney problems and liver problems and stomach, but in actual fact, you were pregnant.
I was pregnant.
And so nobody figured it out.
Well, it was a bit on me. At the very start of the year, I did a pregnancy test, one of those at home ones,
right.
And it said negative.
Right.
So when any time a doctor asked me if I could be pregnant, I just said no.
Yeah.
You know, you're with your parents. You didn't also want to say, oh, yeah, I'm sleeping around.
Right.
So I just said no because the stick said no. So I wiped that off. I was actually genuinely sick somehow. So, yeah, I found out that I was 6 months pregnant.
Wow.
And I remember going back home to mum because I wasn't really living there at the stage. And I walked in. We owned a restaurant and we had a bar. And at the back of the bar is this, like, dark lounge with leather benches and wood on the walls, and there's my mum sitting in the corner smoking a cigarette with a bottle of Glenfiddich and a glass.
Right.
And she didn't yell or scream or anything.
Had you told her?
No. What? She. Well, my stepdad had rang her on the way home, I assume. So she knew, but I hadn't spoken to her. And you know when your parents don't scream at you?
Yeah.
You're really fucked.
Right.
So I was. Well, she sat down and she went, "We'll get through this." And I didn't know what that meant. I'm 16. I'm pregnant. And when you're in the doctors and someone tells you that, I mean, you probably had that when your sentence was read out. Your ears just start ringing. The yeah. world closes in. You feel like you're underwater and you don't know how to process anything. Mm. So we went on that journey, got to the OB very quickly, did the scans, found out I was having a boy. So this is a real-life baby. I only weighed probably about 43 kilos. Jeez. So the doctor said, "You're really undernourished. You have to feed this child. That is your number one thing. I have to put on weight."
Yeah.
I had a completely flat stomach. There's no evidence of it. And I had to go on that journey then. And I was given at the time, there were three options because in Australia we don't do late-term abortions. Mm. So I was told briefly if I wanted to be flown overseas, we could go and do it and go and deal with it. That was a very hard no because I felt this guilt of the fact that I hadn't looked after him. So right. I wasn't actually terminating him at that point when he's kicking me. And then I felt it after. As soon as they said you're pregnant, I was like, that's what that is. Thought.
Wow.
So then the options then at 16 was become a mum or go down the route of adoption.
Wow.
And I had 3 months to decide.
Wow.
3 months to work out which direction my life would take, and both of them permanent.
And which one, like how long did it take you to make that call?
You make, I think I knew internally what I wanted to do, but so I had two different worlds going at the same time. My family is a very traditional Tasmanian farming family. You don't do this. Getting pregnant at 16 is, it's not a thing.
Right.
But I was also living in the world where, you know, I was staying with friends whose parents let us smoke bongs in the house and drive us to drug dealers. Like, so that side of it, they were saying, this is awesome. We'll raise him. It'll be fantastic. I remember they said to me, a baby doesn't care about money or overseas travel. It just needs its mum.
Right.
And then my mum, on the other hand, is going, you have to financially be responsible for this baby.
Yeah.
Like, so I'm playing these two different worlds, and I don't think I really made any decision at any point. It kept changing. But I do remember when I was eating, because I ate a lot from that point in, I remember sitting on the couch and he was, you know, we have this special bond now.
Yeah.
And I remember I said, maybe you'll save me.
Oh, say that again.
Damn it.
It was bound to happen, don't worry.
I said, maybe you'll be the thing that saves me.
From all the drugs and the delinquency and all the stuff that you'd been going through up until that point, yeah.
So was there a part of you didn't know how to stop?
I didn't know. I knew I could.
Right.
But I wasn't working on all the stuff that got me to that point. But I knew at that point that it's not his job to save me.
But was there also a part of you was like, okay, this situation that I'm in this situation and this is where I feel in the situation with the drugs and the family of the drug dealers that were driving you there, did you feel that you were being loved there?
Yeah.
And you had connection there, but you felt in the other hand you didn't have that.
Yeah, I think my parents worked a lot. Like they were always around. We lived in the restaurant. They were always there. But mum is not a stay-at-home mum.
Right.
She didn't drive you to schools. It wasn't like she provided for you, but she – and we could have walked downstairs to spend any time with her. But when you're a kid, I think you always want what you don't have.
So you wanted a dad.
Well, I wanted a mum. Like I wanted parents that were around.
Right. So your mum was kind of dad.
Yeah, she was everything.
So I will just go back a sec. So in your mum kind of was quite clear from the beginning about not financially being responsible for this kid, right? That you were going to, the choice that you made was your choice and that she would be a grandmother but she wasn't going to be the mum. So you were going to have to step up, right?
She was really clear and I think she treated this whole situation well. You made a grown-up decision. You have a grown-up outcome. Nobody can make this decision for you. You have to.
Mm.
But here are my boundaries. And she said, I have raised my children. I'm not going to raise yours. you can't turn 18 and date someone and someone's not going to want a two-year-old kid at 18 and dump this kid on my doorstep.
Right.
That was like she would be a grandma, she would support us and all that sort of stuff.
But you've got to be in.
Yeah, she really showed me what that looked like.
That's good. So then in that moment where you had that conversation with your baby and you were saying, maybe you'll save me, what was that? What happened? What did that make you?
That made me
realize
that I couldn't keep him. It's not his job. Regardless of the money and the private schools and all the things, what I had was opportunity. If I wanted to go and play any sport, I could do it. I never worried where food came from. I never worried how I was going to be clothed. I never worried about these things. And I know every person has a dream for their kid. And I wanted him to not worry. I didn't want him to, you know, I didn't want us to starve. I didn't want us to have to go to laundromats. Like, I just didn't want that. I wanted him to have an opportunity and a real go.
Right.
And not be responsible for saving you.
Yeah, it's not his job to raise me.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do that on my own. And at that point in time, that's where I was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't, in the moment, look at the future and go, right, I've got myself together, I'm good now, I'm financially stable. I wasn't there then. I had to play the cards that were on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not great.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't his job.
So how far along were you at this point?
Probably 6 weeks before I was due.
Mm-hmm. So how did it play out after
that? So what happened next?
So when you go through adoption in Australia now is open adoption. I was one of the first that went through the process with the new reform. So open adoption means that the child must always know that they're adopted. It's a part of their normal conversations. It also means that you pick the parents. So you're fully in control of that. You have court mandated visitation or contact. So the way they sell it to you was that you get to be a part of your child's life and you can see him growing. You're not going to miss that part because, you know, back in the day when they just ripped kids off parents, it's awful. So it was a really nice picture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I guess.
That was sold to you.
That was sold to me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which was, this child's going to be adopted. You're going to be in its life. It's going to know that you're its mother, but there's an adoptive mother as well.
Yeah.
And you're going to be involved in this. Right. And then so where if at that stage, in terms of your usage, you'd obviously stopped.
Yeah.
Okay. If I'm a doctor or I'm a counselor that is overlooking your well-being, would I have looked at you and thought, okay, this kid's a drug addict?
I've read all the case files now and no one specifically says it, but they all thought I was irresponsible.
Right.
I looked, it didn't look great.
Yeah.
I was thin, you know, I didn't look like a drug addict, but I definitely looked like a kid out of school.
Right. And did they meet your mum? The caseworkers and...
Yeah, but mum can't have anything to do with it.
But did they meet her?
They met her and she was there when I wanted her to be, but...
Because I'm just trying to piece together in my head. If it's open adoption, then how come what happened?
Well, this is where we've got to get to, right? How did it play out once you... Because you'd made that call 6 weeks before. What happened in the meantime between then and the birth?
So you interview, you pick parents, you get given, and like now I look back on it like I'm 16, I feel underwater, but you get given resumes and you have to, resume, interview people.
Really?
And I have to sit down with no support and talk to these adults who are going to take my child and ask them questions so you interview them and then you pick them. And I remember meeting the couple that I ended up picking and they just felt really, they felt like grown-ups.
Right.
They felt really safe but caring, like they just loved this child. It almost felt like they just loved me and they just wanted the best for everyone and they were really quite calm and stable. So it was between them and another couple who were dairy farmers and, I picked them and I signed the papers.
Right.
And that's before he was born.
That's before he's born. And then when he was born, I again 16, I had no idea about anything. Mum organised private hospital, a caesarean. She said, you're too young, you're too small.
Yeah.
You can't do that. I'm not letting you do that. You have him in hospital. You are told to bond with him, but not too much.
Mm-hmm.
You're told to spend time with him, but not too much time with him. You go through all this, like, weird stuff. My dad flew in from England. Everybody was there. Mum and dad were in the birth. We all cried as we heard him cry, because as soon as he cried, I was like, fuck, I had done my job. Like, that was all I cared about. You know, I watched them hold him. I watched my brother, you know, run around with him. Like, it was this weird little bubble that we lived in for a period of time. But you knew in 3 or 4 days the foster family was coming and they were going to take him away. And they did that. And
do you remember that?
I remember handing him. I remember signing the forms. I had a seizure, so I was still not able to walk. And then they just kind of came in and said, he's gone now. And you're like, okay, what does that mean? But he went to a foster family. He went to where they put him was about 3.5 hours via public transport for me to get to. So it was now looking back onto it, I don't think it was fair, but you're still meant to see him whilst he's in foster.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I did what I could. I had him for weekends and days and stuff
like
that.
So did they bring him to you?
No, you had to collect him.
So you had to go get him, right, through public transport?
Public transport or friends. I think Mum took me a few times, but she had to work. Like,
Yeah.
This was part of the thing. If I had to make this work. So I had him and I spent time with him, and it was even one of those visits that I said, no, I can do this, because he was just the perfect baby. Like, I don't remember him ever crying. He was just phenomenal. So I said, no, that's it. I'm doing it. And I undid the adoption, because adoption has a 30-day cooling off period.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Like buying a car.
Holy moly.
And then I had him for another long weekend, and, yeah, I looked at him and went, he was too unsettled. He needed a family. He needed a home. And I said, no, I've made the right decision. I need to go back and stick to that decision. So the adoption went through, and he eventually went to his new family. And
sorry, just clarifying, in that foster period, he wasn't with that eventual family. He was somewhere else for that time being.
Really? Yeah, so they go into foster and then they get adopted. I think it's 3 months in foster.
Right.
And then the family has him, and then the adoption takes another 12 months.
Right.
So there is a lot of period of time in between things. Yeah. So he was really unsettled, and the foster family told me every time I brought him back, like, they were dicks, but every time I brought him back, they were like, oh, this really unsettles him. We can't get him to sleep. We can't get him to eat.
Mm.
They were pretty much shaming me for taking him and bringing him back. Like, I don't think they even wanted to give him to me.
Right.
And then they used to complain, like, one time I brought him back and he was wet. And they're like, did you ever even change his nappy? And I'm like, I've just been on a train for 3 hours.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Like, they just made me feel awful. So that was part of the reason why when I decided to go back with the adoption. Yeah. It was a really tough time, because they're telling you to bond, but they're also
telling you gotta hand the baby over.
You gotta hand it over. And it's not like if I decided to keep him, I could have just got him back. Like, caseworkers would have got involved. You have to have long-term visitation. So he was going to be unsettled for quite some time.
Right.
So, yeah, I just decided that it was the right thing. It was the right thing for him.
Yeah.
My job was to protect him.
Yeah. And that was the best way you saw to do it.
It was the best way.
And how old was he by this point once that final choice was made?
6 weeks. I think he was 3 months old. It was the last time I saw him.
Right.
Right. So explain that. What happened that it was the last time you saw him?
God damn it. I was very clear that I was okay with this.
Just because you're okay doesn't mean you're not going to get emotional.
So afterwards, when he fully went to his family, and you don't have visitation, you can't just go and get him. So that was the last time I saw him. And then I went off the rails.
You went what? Off the rails.
Right. I couldn't. The heaviness was a lot. And there's no support around that You know, there's no one explaining the hormonal imbalances.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's
yeah, yeah.
no one. Like, my body was trauma. Yearning yeah. for nurturing a kid that wasn't there. Like, I couldn't understand it. So I went to deal with it in the best way that I knew how at that point. And I went back to drugs and partying and raves, and I just fell in a really deep hole for many, many years. Over that time, I never heard anything.
Right.
No caseworkers followed up with me. I didn't hear any of the contacts or anything like that. But
did your mother hear?
No.
They have to
come to me.
And were they supposed to, what, email you, write to you, call you, yeah. what, any of it?
So once a year it's court mandated that I was to get updates or a request for visitation. I never got that. I never got any information on how he was. I found out much later that he had to have surgery when he was, you know, about 1 or 1.5, and they wanted me to come. Never got to me.
The parents wanted
you to
come.
Yeah, the parents requested to the workers to tell me to come, you know, just so that I knew he was going to be okay, but I never got any of that. So I just kept getting deeper into my depression or darkness or whatever it was and not understanding it. There was no help. And I'm very practical, so that if someone who's never had kids is trying to counsel me on what it's like to give a kid up for adoption, I don't particularly listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no book that can explain
mm-hmm.
what that feels like. So the counsellors were all useless. Mum tried, but nobody understood, and I just went off the rails. When he was eight, I had got my life back on track. I was doing really well. And I reached out to the adoption workers, because before he turns 18, it has to all go through the adoption company. You can't circumnavigate it at all. So I contacted them and said, listen, I really want to hear how he is and I want to reach out. And they wrote back immediately saying, write a letter, send some photos, we'll send it on. So I did that. I'm like, here's all the stuff, sorry. But I needed to go off the rails for a bit, and I wasn't proud enough to write and say.
Yeah.
So. And then the family wrote back immediately. They sent me photos of him.
Wow.
And, you know, just gave me this beautiful update. But they also asked some health questions. He'd just been diagnosed with Asperger's. And so they're like, is anyone in your family got that? And I'm like, all of us. All of us. Yeah. So I wanted to really, you know, write back and support them in that. So I wrote back, and then I never heard anything ever again.
What does ever again mean? Up until when?
Up until, so that was 10 years. Every year I was writing on his birthday and sending updates and photos and things, and every year I got nothing back.
Right.
And I kept telling myself that, because he's got Asperger's and it's not my place, that I should just be okay with it.
Right.
And, you know, I know what my family's like. Unless you're in their face, they don't think about, like, that's just how we all are. So every year I would write and I get nothing back. Right, I get nothing back. When he was about 16, I started to get worried that he was even alive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like questioning in the back of my head, is this kid even alive? And I was Googling, like, because I know their first names, but that's all I knew. I was Googling whether there was car accidents or things happening, because I couldn't understand why I was getting nothing back. But in my, I would justify it publicly. Yeah, he's got Asperger's, he's busy, I gave him up, I shouldn't expect to hear something. And then when he was about to turn 18, I wrote him the big letter, the explanation of everything. I tried to explain to him, you know, why, talk to him about his family. Like, I, you know, it was 4 pages of love, of trying to get him to reach out to me. And at the very end of it, I just said, just tell me you're okay. That's all I cared about. Because when he turned 18, there's no way to contact him. You have to go through the adoption workers. After 18, he's got to ask for records and you've got to go do it that way. And it's a bit of a painful process. And then even at 18, I got nothing back. Nothing. And there's.
So just let me interrupt you there. What's happening for you in all of that? Like, as, like, what, other than obviously not understanding whether he's here or not, alive or not. What's going on for you?
Everything awful. I was able to put on a brave face, but I have been miserable for 22 years. Just this overwhelming feeling of emptiness. I used to tell people, I didn't know how to explain it, but I used to tell people that my soul was dead.
Mm.
And I wasn't suicidal, even though I went through times of that, but, you know, I'd drive home at night and I wish the truck coming the other way would just take me out.
Mm.
So was it a, do you feel like it was almost like a lack of feeling, like it was like there was nothing there? Yeah.
Was there a part of you asking yourself if you had tried hard enough?
100%.
Right. And had you been, had that been part of like the, had that been part of, it was obviously part of how you ridiculed yourself and beat yourself up with it, right? And, but do you think that was also, without that, you wouldn't have driven to want to know if he actually was okay? Right.
So what happened? So this is eight, he was eight. So he's about 22 now, did you say? Or 21, yep. 22.
22.
Yeah.
So at 18, I cracked the shit. I just got very angry. When I'm angry, I get shit done. So I contacted the adoption office head office.
When you were 18?
When he was 18. 18.
And when so he was 18, sorry.
About 3 years ago, three right. and a half years ago. And I contacted the CEO and I just went head over heels on complaints.
Right.
How fucking dare you? No one is responding. He's now 18. Somebody call me back. So this little young girl rings me and is a bit afraid. She's like, listen, I promise we'll give you a call in 24 hours and find out what's going on. But because he's 18, we don't have his case anymore, blah, 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 blah. So then a few days later, someone rang me and they apologized, but they told me there'd been an administration error. And the caseworker that I was assigned actually retired and they forgot to pass on my case to any other worker. And that email address was not ever watched or no one checked on it for like 10 years. And it's not just like I felt, because I'm also operations and systems, that made me feel sick. Like these people are in control of our very well-being and you just failed to tell us or even put an autoresponder on an email. If I sent an email and it came back, hey, this person's not here, call an office, I probably would have done it.
Right.
I still felt like a dick that I could have done more earlier. I beat myself up over that, but I still teetered on the fact that I wasn't worthy enough. Like, you gave a child up for adoption. I shouldn't have a right to force that.
Yeah.
So you're playing in both those worlds. So, yeah, they wrote back and they're just like, we're really sorry. There's nothing we can do about it. It's now gone off to the governing body of it. So I had to contact them and I got this caseworker who was just lovely. She was just a godsend. And she got all my case files. She read them all. She redacted all. She, her and I had meeting after meeting after meeting. And then she said, do you think you're ready for me to reach out to the family? And I said, yes. So she wrote a letter to the family, or to him, and 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, nothing. Nothing came back. But she had to send a standard letter. She couldn't explain what had happened.
Right.
And then she sent another one. And he wrote back saying, I don't wish to have contact.
Right.
You know, this is my family. I don't, thank you, Amelia, for finding me, but please let her know I don't wish to have contact. And that was the day I met Gabby. And I just cried.
Right.
At work. and then the caseworker rang me and said, would you like, she was going to go off book, ring them and explain what happened. So she rang them and explained to his mum what had happened and his mum went, okay, we get this, we're sorry. And she started communicating with me.
Right.
So over the last sort of 2 years, we've been exchanging emails and photos and I've been getting updates on him and it's been much nicer.
Mm.
So she's obviously realised that when she tried to reach out to you about the operation, that it wasn't you just ignoring her, it was the fact that you never got that information.
Did they get him all the letters?
No, No, because they were gone.
Fuckers.
So I've got a lot of them. So every letter they've ever sent me, I've never got.
Right.
So she updated.
Right.
She was doing what she...
But she sounds like she's great.
She's phenomenal. She's just a really beautiful human. Like,
so that would have settled you at some level, knowing that he was okay, even knowing that he didn't want to have, you know, didn't want to have contact. That would have given you at least an awareness that he was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
I felt, and
did you know he was okay though?
No.
No way?
No.
What are you talking about beforehand?
Yeah. Was there a part of you throughout the years knew that he was all right? That he was still alive? Like, could you feel he was still alive? That everything was okay?
No. There was this. No. Maybe if I really looked at it, but I had this really deep fear.
Yeah.
It was like this, like an emptiness that you didn't know how to. I don't know. That's how you've kind of explained it to me. It's almost like that without actually hearing about it, it's this. It's the self. I don't know, the self worth part of like, did I do right? Did I do right? So the constant, the not having the confirmation out there was never going to quench this understanding in here at some level.
100%. I never, like logically I could say I did the right thing at the time, but when you don't know, I'm like, you just feel like an awful, empty human being and nothing, like I did not know. Did I know he was all right? Probably. I think I would have felt it if.
Yeah. I think that's what I'm saying because there's the part that we're trying to deal with what has gone on and then there's their knowing. Do you know what I mean? And their knowing is just the connection that I have with my mother, the connection you have with your mother. You know, you can just know when something's okay. It's that other sense. You know what I mean? And then there's all, okay, I've got to deal with all of this other shit. Like, what the fuck is going on? Why aren't they contacting me? Why aren't they reaching out? It's meant to be an open adoption. What is happening? You know?
Yeah. So with that you had to choose whether it was weekly or monthly or how often you could see him, right? And what did you choose?
Yearly.
So you chose the yearly. And then, okay. And then it just didn't happen.
Stuff. And I've met people who adopted a child and the birth mother wanted weekly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm like...
How could you do it?
How could you do that? Mm-hmm.
It's kind of not fair in a way.
It's not fair. So you also reckon, like, you're trying to deal with that. Like,
folks for strokes, though, you know.
What I wanted for him was to have a family that he loved. And in a way, I wished he'd never come looking for me because that meant he had questions. And if he had questions, it meant... You know, maybe he felt a part of him was missing.
Or maybe he wasn't happy where he was.
Correct. Yeah. And that was my biggest fear. Like, what if any of that happened? So when I found out that he's great, he's had a beautiful life, he loves his family, like, that did fix a lot of me, I guess. I felt much better. I felt relieved, I guess. But there was still, you know, a part of you that, it's just hard to explain. It's really,
Not quite. The pieces of the puzzle haven't quite fit together yet. Yeah. So what happened next?
So his mum and I were back and forth updating.
He didn't necessarily want the communication directly, but he was okay for his mum to communicate.
Yeah, he said he's not ready. But he's happy to go through and he reads everything that her and I send, but he doesn't want to directly communicate at this point. But his mum and I, because they're in a different state, said that next time we're in each other's state, we'll meet up for coffee. So in February, I flew over and we organised to meet up for coffee.
Great. How did it go?
It was interesting. Because I was having a bit of anxiety of what do you say?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know, do you hug these people? How do you, like, I didn't know what to do. And then, of course, I couldn't get my hair right. I looked fat. My
outfits
were terrible.
Didn't know what to wear.
I ended up getting dermatitis. Like, it was awful.
You're having a visceral reaction.
Yeah, it was not good. But we walked into the cafe and they just went in for a hug. And they just started crying. And I started crying. And even my mum was there, she started crying. And I just felt really instantly at ease that whatever happened, this was going to be okay.
Lovely.
We were talking and they showed me videos of him and, like, I heard his voice for the first time.
Right.
Like, even though I had known a bit about his life, like, to hear his voice was like a... But then I was like, fuck, why didn't I think of asking for that? Like,
yeah.
But then his mum said at one point that he wanted me to know. He told her to tell me that he thanks me every day for the decision I made. He just loves his life and he loves his family. And I tell you, this emptiness inside me in that moment just got filled.
Yeah.
For the first time in 22 years. Like, I tell everybody all the time, I don't know why people were friends with me before this point. I was a miserable cow. And now I'm like laughing and I'm enjoying life, like I'm smiling, and all I needed to hear that he was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been a... I get angry on the other sense that they don't educate you on some of the impact that it can have on this.
Mm.
But it's just been such an amazing 22 years. And at the end of the day, I got everything that I asked for.
Mm.
I wanted him to have a family that he just loved and adored and that adored him. And then I just wanted everybody to be okay.
But the funny thing is, you know, we expect that to come about in a certain way. It's the old cliche of you ask for courage and you get challenges. And it's, you know, how that love came about was perhaps that you actually needed to not be around him.
Yeah.
And and that kept him in your heart and in your mind, and it kept you, you know, a mother's love no matter what the distance is inseparable, you know. And so I think that the like my brain immediately goes to, okay, well, what would the drawbacks have been if she had been in contact with him the whole time? You know, would he have come out? He obviously had difficulties. Would he have come out as stable and be able at the age of 22, I think he is now, to be able to say something like, tell her, you know?
Yeah. I remember you telling me, Mels, that, you know, because the impact, like I've never allowed a relationship close enough to ask for kids.
Yeah.
I blocked all of that part of me. And if anyone ever asked me if I wanted kids, the answer was no, I hate them.
Yeah.
Like, no way. But I just spent 22 years protecting him.
Yeah.
I just carried him with me. I still do all this time. Like, and to see that. And
but you know, the other thing is, AG, right? Like, so many people never recover from that, especially when they're in addiction. And they give up a child. They never get out of it. They can't get out of in their mind, this is irreparable and I cannot bear to handle what I'm actually experiencing. So the only way for me to be able to handle this is to escape into addiction. And, you know, what it takes for you to pull yourself out of that situation. And like you even think about what happened to you. Like, all of that was an angel in disguise, making sure that you've... Because, I mean, when you go through the rest of your life and you end up in hairy situations where things are put in front of you, where you are in situations where it's very fucking easy to slip up,
yep.
Especially when you're dealing with addiction. You know, you can slip up and we're all just one slip up away from fucking homelessness and living on the street and being absolutely fucking ruined and never making anything out of anything. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the fact, like, if you think about it is actually such a wonderful story. Do you know what I mean? And what a great, you know, I know you haven't met him yet, but I also go, well, that's because it's just not time.
It's not time.
No.
And I don't need to now.
Yeah.
Like, I will be there for him whenever he needs to, but that darkness or that emptiness was so big.
Yeah.
That right now I'm like.
Yeah.
I can finally feel that I can breathe.
Yeah, yeah.
I can enjoy my life. And now I'm in a position to actually, you know, understand it. Like, I didn't know that the cells of your baby stay with you forever.
Yeah.
And they see them. They've now found them in the brain that sparks the nurturing part. Like, there's a part of you always connected to this child, and to not understand that and to feel these things and to go through that, it was just, but now I'm like, like Mel thinks I'm drunk half the time because I'm just loving life.
Smiling a bit more.
Almost hugging people.
Yeah, I've found out the other day, like I knew about some of the, you know, the cells in the cells of the baby stay with the mother forever, but the cells of the baby actually go in to protect the mother. And I never knew that. Like when the immune system is down and when stuff's going on for the mother, the babies that were birthed or not birthed will still be in the mother and go in to protect the mother.
Yep.
And that is like when I saw beautiful. That the other day, it's just beautiful. Yeah. You know, it's just beautiful. And I think what I've said to you the whole time is that as much as you struggled with the not knowing and the not being close and the not and the dramas of, you know, the mix up operationally of what happened, none of that stopped you from being a mum. And you've been a mum for that whole time. And I think that you just thought that being a mum needed to look like my letters get through and he knows that I'm there and he can communicate with me whenever he wants. But none of that outside stuff was ever going to get in the way of you being his mum. And the fact that he also said that shows that he knew that too. You know, he knew, right, like if he thanks you every day, then he's grateful every day for the life that he's got, you know.
And I mean the core values of a mother to a child is protect the child, which you did, and keep the child alive, which you did, you know, and make sure the child is safe, which you did. And whatever it takes is whatever a mother will do. You have to do whatever it takes, including not be there, including, you know, not, you know, when there's a party, you go, should I do more? Actually, not do more. Should I have? Well, actually, no, you shouldn't have. How it happened was exactly how it was meant to have happened.
And hindsight's a beautiful thing, though, because you can see that in looking back, you can go, if this, then this wouldn't have happened, or if that, then that wouldn't have happened. But going through it, but all of that, it didn't just birth him, that birthed you. The fact that, you know, at 16 years old, you were able to turn yourself around for this kid, like you, nothing was going to stop you from with the drugs and the alcohol and all the other bits and pieces. And then once you found out about this kid, you turned everything around, right? And then, sure, you went back to it because there was a sense of emptiness and not because you're a kid, you didn't know how to regulate, you didn't know how to handle all of that. So sure, you went back to it, but you instinctively knew what to do, and he was teaching you the whole time, regardless of whether you were close or not close. You know, you've got I feel like you've got a bit of a mission now in terms of this adoption thing. You know, telling, even just for you telling this story, do you want to share what you feel about that? What your thoughts are there?
It's such a topic that is not spoken about, and I think adoption is a beautiful thing, mm-hmm. despite everything that I went through.
Mm.
There's only 10,000 adoptions in Australia now, and 98% of them, I think, are with kids that are significantly disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, over the last few years, I actually looked at becoming a foster mum and looked into that system, and I went, that is just...
It's horrendous.
Horrific.
Yeah, it's still bad in Australia.
And I couldn't do it because I couldn't... it was just awful, but I just think we need to talk more about it. We need to talk more about the options. We need to have more support for the mothers. We need to tell them, you know, about the cells, and that maybe if you're feeling this way, that that's okay, you know.
Mm.
I remember in hospital they told me to take these two pills, and I was like, what are these for? After I took them, and they're like, it's to dry up your milk. And it's like, no one tells you all of the impacts that are going to have with you. There's no support groups, there's no communication, there's nothing. And those, you know, all the counselors and the workers, they're great. They're, you know, they were doing what they could, but they're, some of them are just kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they don't understand these conversations or how to do it, because there is a feeling within you that never goes away.
Mm.
And it's whether you lose a child, you know, go through an abortion or do an adoption, there's an emptiness that you need to learn how to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, did you know who the father was?
Yes.
Okay. How do you feel about that?
He and I were in love, you know. But we were kids. He was older than me. He was over 18. Now that I look at it, I'm like, probably not so good. He thought I was lying when I told him I was pregnant. And then when he heard I'd given birth, he went, oh. So he came back for a bit. But, you know, he's not a great person. He's not someone that I would want around my children now. So,
yeah.
But he, the decision was made with him.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, we both got in that situation. So he was comfortable. He signed the papers as well. And he's able to have full contact, but he has chosen not to.
It's a wonder he wasn't charged.
Well, my mum sort of just put all that together now we're talking about. She was like, ah. Oh.
Yeah.
You know, he was feeding me a lot of the things I was taking.
Right, right.
So, but I loved him, you know. He was at a school cusp. It was fine, but...
16.
Yeah, 16. This
happens, yeah.
Mm.
But he was only there for a couple of weeks.
Right.
So where to from here? Where are you at with everything?
I just... more chickens. I think now you guys understand why I smother my dog so much.
Yeah.
But I just want to keep talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to reach out, you know, the caseworker that helped me over the last few years. You know, I really want to talk about reform in this space.
Mm.
I really want people women to understand there are options and it is beautiful. Even though my story is, it had its problems, he's got a beautiful life. Mm-hmm. And I'm a pretty good human being despite it all. So I think we just need to talk about it. And if anyone doesn't know where to go or went through this process and feels lonely, then they need to reach out to us. Because this is the work you guys have been helping me with for years and years and years.
You know, I know we've got to kind of finish it up now, but Mitch is right in what he's saying, the fact that some people really don't get out of that. And you were 16, you were a baby when you think about it, you know, and you've just given birth and your hormones are doing all the things and then you've gone off the rails, but you brought yourself back and you were able to do that. And then not just do that, but you were able to do the work that you needed to do to be able to get to the point that you're at now. And I think that is because I know that, you know, I've done enough, you know, chats with you and working with you to know that you understand how this work works, that you wouldn't go back and change it, that you wouldn't go back and, you know, you understand the blessings that have happened, but that doesn't mean it doesn't give you a bit of a mission to educate people. And, like, it takes a lot of courage to come in and share your story. I know that you wanted to be on the podcast after this happened so that we could share the story, you know, and it takes a lot of courage to do that. But, yeah, I just want you to know that, you know, I see that and I think that, like... I keep saying it to you, but, you know, that's what a mum does.
Yeah.
You know, that's what a mum does. And I think regardless of whether your kid is there or whether he's not there, whether whatever's going on, that's what a mum does. So you did good. You did good.
Thanks. I'm just grateful to you guys and grateful for the fact that I didn't stop trying.
Mm.
I kept going even though sometimes it was hard. Because you're right, a lot of people don't get out of it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's been a beautiful process and I'm just really grateful to be here now. And I've never spoken about it because of that. It didn't have its, not conclusion, it's just begun, but I didn't have the answer. I still felt like a shit human being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now it's like, it's time to talk about it.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, part of healing is you got to talk, you know, because the thing about talking is people have to understand that when you talk, there is no destination. It'll work itself out.
It's a process. But
the reason we talk is because it allows us to work it out. We start to hear what we're saying and we start to go, well, that's correct and that's not correct. Well, that makes sense and that doesn't make sense. Or I need to make sense of that because it doesn't make sense. And that's why you know, we have a tongue and a mouth as much as it's a chomping mechanism for a small and large intestine. Your mouth is there and developed to communicate so that your logical brain and your emotional brain could actually work things out and come to an understanding. You know, okay, I get a deeper knowing of what has happened here. I get a deeper knowing of what occurred. And that's what awaits every person when they talk, is a deeper knowing. And that's why you need to talk. And with men or women, because, you know, we haven't discussed how it is for men on their side when they have to do something like that. But no matter what or no matter who you are or where you are, no matter what is going on, the best thing to do is find somebody you can talk to and start to fucking talk. Don't be afraid to talk and understand talking does not have a destination. It is a process of actually figuring out who you are in the presence of everything that's happening. And in the presence of everything that's happening, it's all love when you stop and you look and speak.
We appreciate you coming along and sharing.
Good job, mate.
Thanks, guys.
Love it. And you got your wish. She cried.
Oh, I feel terrible that I fucking said that.
It was inevitable. Thanks, Amelia. Thanks, we appreciate guys. It.